Okay, let's get started. Hi, everybody. So we are back to our Yerushalayim series. Let's share screen. I don't have the sources to put on, but don't worry. It's really only one thing. It's the timeline. So even if you don't have it, you can see it very clearly on the PowerPoint. Yofi. Okay. Yes. No. To slideshow. Okay, we are gonna get started. Very good. Okay, hi everyone. So last time we did, 2 weeks ago, we did kind of a background history of Yerushalayim. Why is Jerusalem important to each of the three major religions that are here? Everybody, if you're not muted, please mute yourself. And today, what we are going to do is we are going to take a look at the Christian quarter. We're going to be looking at three of the four quarters in depth. We're not going to do the Jewish quarter because we did it a different time, but we're going to do the Christian quarter, the Muslim quarter, the Armenian quarter. So today is the turn of the Christian quarter. I just love this picture with the snow. It is not snowing here, but pictures of Yerushalayim in the snow are always interesting, are always nice. The Christian quarter, I wanted to start with it because it, first of all, Christianity, of course, comes before Islam, and the city expanded to the Christian quarter towards the end of Second Temple time. So there is a lot of history there. The focus in the Christian quarter is going to be, as we're going to see as we go on the Church of the Holy Sepulchre. That is the place that all Christian groups, except for one, we'll get to that, want to be close to. And that's the most significant building here. Much of what is going on in the Christian quarter is Christian, i.e. churches, residents, etc. However, we're going to see there are also two mosques. There is Jewish-owned property and some Jewish families that are in the Christian quarter. There are stores that are not necessarily owned only by the Christians. First of all, there are Armenian-owned stores who are Christian, but they have their own quarter, and many, many Muslims. So we're going to see a variety of different structures, but of course, the focus here is on the church, on Christianity, and just to give us a little bit of sense of numbers. Okay, in Jerusalem, there are a total of 11,500 Arab Christians. This is in all of Jerusalem, not only in the Old City. Okay, and in all of Jerusalem, so 11,500 Arab Christians, 3,000 non-Arab Christians. Okay, meaning their ethnicity is different. They could be European, all different sorts. In the Old City, of that number, in the Old City, you have 4,300 Christians. Right, some of them Arab, mostly Arab, some non-Arab, as well as, and out of that 4,300, 3,000 are in the Christian quarter. Right, so let's just do those numbers one more time. 11,500 Arab Christians in Jerusalem, plus another 3,000 non-Arab Christians. Out of that, approximately 14,500, you have 4,300 in the Old City itself. And out of that 4,300, you have 300 in the Christian quarter. I hope that made sense. Okay, we're not including the Armenians who have their own quarter. The Russians have their church outside. The Protestants are a separate story, but let's get started and we'll see as we go along. Okay, before we do anything, let's understand what we are talking about, right? So where's the Christian quarter in the Old City? Start out in the bottom, right? The map of the entire Old City. So we are in the northwest corner. We are between, let's just annotate a little bit, it's helpful. Okay, so we are basically between Jaffa Gate over here and Damascus Gate over here. Northwest corner, we're going to talk about at what point this became part of Jerusalem, not from the very beginning, okay, but we'll get to that. Within here, okay, as I said, the main thing we want to be focusing on, the main thing that everybody is focusing on, is the Church of the Holy Sepulchre, right, which is one of the oldest things in here. Everybody wants to be close to it, and we are also going to be taking a look at Newgate. Right. Next to Newgate is the area of the Franciscans, Saint Savior. Right. the Greek Orthodox Patriarchate, also super important. Main commercial streets here, right, from Jaffa Gate, you have Rehov David, which is what goes straight into the Shuk, and you also have Christian Quarter Road, also major commercial road, okay? You have mosques on either side of the church, okay? One on El Hanka, okay, and one kind of over here, more or less, okay, on either side flanking the church. And we're also going to talk about the Moristan, okay? So that's just to give us a little bit of a sense of the places that we're talking about in terms of our old city map, just to understand the other parts of it, right? The red is the Christian quarter. Down here is the Armenians. Here are the Jews, and here are the Muslims. Okay, so just to give us a little bit of a feeling of where things are. I hope that made sense to everybody. Okay, I see a question. We tend to equate Arabs with Muslims. You are correct that that is untrue. What are the origins of Christian Arabs, right? So mostly it's Arabs that have been in the Holy Land for a long time, that have been in the land of Israel for a long time, that at some point converted to Christianity or married into Christian families, right? We know when the Crusaders came, a lot of them, you had men married local women, right? So that's, and stuck around. So they may have originally Arab, non-Arab origins, or at least partly non-Arab origins, but they've been here for centuries upon centuries, or they have converted from Arab countries to Christianity. Okay, let's take a look at our timeline for a moment. Okay, and this is the one thing that there was in the sources. So we have in the first temple period, as in the time of Tanakh, right? From the time when Jerusalem becomes under the control of King David, we looked at this last time, until 586, until the destruction of the first temple by the Babylonians and the exile. The what we call the Christian quarter is outside the city, right? And in fact, let's just go back for 1 second. Right, the city of Jerusalem by Rishon in First Temple time starts out in Ir David down here, goes up to include Har Habayit, to include the Temple Mount, and eventually includes the area all the way to Jaffa Gate. But it does not include this northwestern part. It includes the southwestern part, but it doesn't include the northwestern part of the Christian quarter. Okay. The beginning of the Second Temple period, right, Shivat Zion, the Persian period, the Jews come back, the Christian quarter is outside the city, but as we're going to see in a more detailed map in a couple of minutes, the city grows, right, and expands in the Second Temple times greatly, starts out very, very small, and it expands, and by the time we get to the end of the first century before the Common Era, the area of the Christian quarter, at least part of it, right, seems to be included in the city. I say part of it because we're going to be talking about the Church of the Holy Sepulchre and at what point that became part of the city. Certainly by the destruction, right, by Churban Bayit, by the time of year 70, the Christian quarter is part of the city. But the big question is going to be in the time of Jesus, and we'll come back to that. Okay? Roman period, after the destruction of the temple until the Roman Empire becomes Christian, the area of the Holy Sepulchre, which is not a church yet, is a pagan temple. Okay? The Romans also build a forum, a marketplace. They build a street. By the time we get to the Byzantines and the Christianizing, right, the conversion of the Roman Empire to Christianity, you have the beginning of the Church of the Holy Sepulchre. You have the Cardo becoming the main street, and you have much more importance being assigned to this area of the Christian quarter. When the Arabs conquer, right, the year 630, the Arabs come, they conquer the land of Israel, they conquer Jerusalem, but they allow the church to remain, they allow the Christians to stay, right? The Crusaders do not return the favor, and when they conquer the city in 1099, partly because they want to defend the Church of the Holy Sepulchre, they massacre all the Muslims, they massacre all the Jews, and they of course keep the Christian character of the Holy Sepulchre and of the Christian quarter, but they add other things as well. Okay? Crusader period is also the beginning of the time of the Franciscans. We're going to talk about them in a minute. Okay? When the Muslims come back, right, Mamluk times, and then Ottoman times, they allow the Christians to stay, but they confine them to their quarter. It's only at the end of the Ottoman period in the late 19th century, mid 19th to early 20th century, is when the Ottomans kind of allow the Christians to move out. They go towards the Muslim quarter as well. And that's also the time when we have the Maristan and we have the opening of Newgate. Okay. If all, not all of these terms are familiar, don't worry, we're going to be coming back to them. So let's start with Newgate. Newgate is the entrance, the direct entrance into the Christian quarter. You can actually drive into it. This is a picture where you're inside the old city looking out, right? Looking out at Notre Dame or one of the newer buildings of Notre Dame across the street. Newgate, kishmo kenhu, right? It's new, right? Unlike the other gates and the walls of the old city, whose most recent iteration is the Ottoman period, is Sultan Suleiman the Magnificent, 16th century. Newgate dates only to the end of the 19th century, right? 1889. Sultan Abdul Hamid, right, also Ottoman, right? Sultan Abdul Hamid is petitioned by the nuns of Notre Dame who live across the street outside the walls of the old city. And they say to him, listen, we want to be able to go to the Church of the Holy Sepulchre, but the way we have to go today is we have to go all the way to Jaffa Gate and then all the way back into the Christian quarter. Will you make us an entrance directly into the Christian quarter? And Abdul Hamid agrees, right? And that's Newgate. So it's only from the end of the 19th century to allow easy access directly into the Christian quarter. We are going to see that right next to it is where the Franciscans are. Okay. They have their headquarters in a place called Saint Xavier. They used to be on Mount Zion, 16th century. The Muslims kicked them out and they moved to right inside of Newgate. They have a high school here called the College des Frères. It's built on the remains of a Crusader building called Tancred's Tower, which the Arabs call Goliath's Tower. What's the logic? Well, if we have Migdal David, right, if we have David's Tower not far away, David was here, Goliath was probably here too, right? So they call this structure Goliath Tower. It's with very, very old stones, perhaps from Second Temple times. Okay? So all of this is in and around the vicinity of Newgate. One of the things I didn't add in here, but it's interesting, is that in recent years, Newgate has been undergoing a little bit of a renaissance. It's got some new stores that are here. It's becoming kind of more European and not necessarily only Arab. There's like a fancy bakery here. There is a wine bar here, which is very not Muslim, right? And during Corona, in fact, during COVID, when Israelis couldn't travel abroad, right? Israelis love to travel abroad. And when we were still in that period where you couldn't go anywhere outside the country, the airports were locked down. Jerusalem, that first summer of COVID, the summer of 2020, things were opening up a little bit, but you couldn't leave the country. And they advertised the Christian quarter, particularly Newgate, as Hachi Chul Sheyesh, the most like outside the country that you can imagine, which is a hilarious slogan. But you know, if you wanted to go to Europe to see churches and to go and walk through ancient cobblestone streets, you don't have to go to Europe. Just come to the Christian quarter. And the Christian quarter is trying to develop that tourism sense. So that's just an interesting side note that I didn't put in pictures of it, but it's nice to know about. Between 1948 and 1967, Newgate was closed because it really was directly on the border, on the seam line. And this picture that you're seeing here on the left, this is a picture of Notre Dame in 1948. We'll come back to this picture in one second, but Notre Dame on the roof, which you can see very nicely up here, there were Israeli soldiers up there because it was literally on the border, and they were looking at the Jordanian soldiers in the old city. And there was no man's land between Notre Dame and between the old city, and nobody could pass through and go through Newgate. Why is there a very large hole in Notre Dame? Because on May 18th, 1948, Jordanian tanks were advancing from the area of Shaar Shechem, of Damascus Gate, trying to break through to the western part of Jerusalem, trying to break through to the new city. And the only way they could be stopped was you had tanks coming, right? How do you stop tanks? So what the Jews did was they blew up a wing of Notre Dame, and the building, of course, fell into the street, blocked the tanks, saved Jewish Jerusalem from being taken over by the Jordanians. Did not exactly endear us to the nuns and the monks of Notre Dame, but it was something that really did save the city. In the years of that seam line, right, when the city was divided and Notre Dame was on the edge, it still served as a church, and it served, perhaps more importantly, as a hospital. And we have a very famous story about a patient waking up one morning and opening up her window in order to get some fresh air, and then having a coughing fit. And in her coughing fit, she spat her false teeth out into no man's land. This was in the 1950s, 1956. And it became an international incident because you couldn't just go down and find the teeth. They had to be in touch with the UN, and with Israel and with the Jordanians. And you had a group of three different representatives who went down with the nuns to look for the teeth. And this was such a great story that it actually was featured in Life magazine, and they found the teeth and they returned them. But this was a very tense time between 48 and 67, even though you have this kind of an amusing story. The other picture here is a plaque that was in memory of an attack that was in July of 1948. In July of 1948, you had something called Mivtza Kedem, Operation Kedem, where you had a combination of the forces of the Irgun and the Lehi who tried to break into the old city, right? This is after the Jewish quarter surrendered at the end of May 1948. We tried to take it back. In July of 1948, they broke through Newgate, but it was not successful. And of course, the old city remained in Jordanian hands until the Six-Day War, until 1967. So that's two
Did they
more
call
recent
that
things that are
story?
connected to Newgate. Okay, so
Did they
let's take a
call that
look at
story about?
maps for a second. So the map on the left here is Jerusalem in First Temple times. Okay, and we looked at this a little last time, but let's understand it again, right? The city begins down here by the city of David, where the water is. In the time of King Solomon, it expands to Mount Moriah. And by the time we get to Chizkiyahu, right, the last 120 years of First Temple times, the city has expanded all the way to Jaffa Gate. We know this because of archaeology. We've actually found pieces of Chizkiyahu's wall. However, this area up here, right, this is what we call the Christian quarter. This is outside the city. So that's First Temple times. Second Temple times, take a look at the map over here on the right, and this is a little bit more complicated. In the beginning, right, Shivat Zion, the Persian period, Jerusalem is a very narrow little strip. This is the time of Zerubbabel and then Ezra and Nehemiah. Okay. It starts out very, very narrow. We know this is a very, very difficult time in Jewish history. We don't have a lot of defenders of the city. We don't have a lot of population. However, by the time we get to the Hanukkah story, right, the Hashmonaim, the 2nd century before the Common Era, the city has grown to be the borders of Chizkiyahu's city. This is what we call, or Josephus really calls, the first wall. Okay, by the time of Churban Bayit, by the time the Second Temple is destroyed in the year 70, the city grows beyond, and this is, we looked at these maps last time a little bit, beyond the boundaries of the wall of today, right? That's this kind of nice gray little wall here. The city grows all the way to include the area that today we would call the Russian compound and Mea Shearim. That's called the third wall. However, in between, at some point, right, probably late 1st century before the Common Era, early 1st century of the Common Era, we have a second wall. And the big question is, where is that wall? We have remains of this first wall. We have remains of the third wall. The second wall is much trickier because it's underneath the homes of the city. And how do we know where it is? So if you've been to the model of Jerusalem, used to be called the Holy Land model, used to be in the Holy Land, now it's in the Israel Museum. They make these walls, right? This was done in the 60s. And the walls were drawn as you can see here, okay, in kind of a strange way, right? This weird little corner. Why do you have this weird little corner? Guess why? Because the Holy Sepulchre is here. What's the Holy Sepulchre? It's a burial place. If it's included in the boundaries of the city in the time of Jesus, he can't be buried there, right? Because we don't bury inside the city. So, when Michael Abiona made the model, he did not include the Holy Sepulchre inside the walls, right? I hope that makes sense to everybody. Now, is that correct? Is that not correct? We don't have proof of where the walls are, but we are going to see that we do have proof that there were tombs here in the area of the Holy Sepulchre. So presumably he is correct about the walls. All right, but I just want you to understand this concept, right? Beginning of Second Temple times, very narrow. Later, Hashmonaiim period also doesn't include the Christian quarter, but by the time we get to the very end of Second Temple times, the Christian quarter is inside the city. So I hope that makes sense to everybody. We're going to go on and continue. We can come back to that if people have questions. But let's understand what was in this area in the time of Second Temple times. So this is a pool. It's actually a fascinating thing. It's a courtyard right adjacent to the Shuk. It used to be completely filled with garbage. As you can see, there's a lot of garbage here. It was cleaned up by the people who live in the houses nearby, but it was clearly, and you can see this on rainy days, it was clearly some kind of a thing to hold water. Okay. It's known in the old city as Hezekiah's Pool, Brichat Chizkiyahu. But it is not connected to Hezekiah. It's part of the aqueduct system that was made by Herod to bring water to the Temple Mount. And this was a pool. So a pool is usually kind of on the edges of the city. So in Herod's time, this is still on the edges of the city, but it's an important part of the water system bringing water to the Temple Mount. What about in Roman times? Okay, Roman times, the temple has been destroyed, but the Romans are expanding the city and they build a main street. We're going to see the street very soon. They build a temple, a pagan temple to Aphrodite in the area where the Holy Sepulchre is. Okay? And we have, and this is actually a great thing, when you walk into Jaffa Gate, on your left is like a very cute little courtyard that has a hotel from the 19th century. All of it, as you can see, partly owned by the Franciscans, partly owned by the Greeks. But in this courtyard is a lamppost, right? Everybody sees the lamppost. But what is the pillar of the lamppost? The pillar of the lamppost is a Roman milestone. Hey, the Romans love to put up these things all along their roads, telling you who is the who was the Caesar who built it, who are the different Roman legions who built it, right? So you can see that it says here very nicely and clearly, okay, Legio XFR. Legio, leg as in legion, X as in the Roman numeral 10, 10th legion. And the FR is Fritensis. Each of the legions had a name. The 10th legion, Fritensis, this is the legion that conquers Jerusalem, that destroys the Second Temple. They put up one of their milestones, probably not here. It was probably moved from somewhere else, but it's fascinating to be able to see it in perfect condition and in kind of very interesting secondary use as part of a lamppost. Hey, isn't the broad wall part of the second wall? No, it's not part of the second wall. The broad wall is a wall from First Temple times, okay? And in the same area is the Hashmonai wall, but it's not part of the second wall. Hey, the other picture I put in here, if you walk down Christian Quarter Road in the Shuk, you'll see that the modern paving stones at a certain point give way to these massive paving stones, which is actually fascinating. Israel in the 1970s did a renovation in the Shuk and they uncovered these huge stones. These stones date back to the Roman period. These date back to the late third, early fourth century. Okay. And this is part of a Roman street that was built here, right? The Romans built part of the Cardo. They built a street in the north in the Muslim quarter. We're going to see that when we talk about the Muslim quarter, but they built a street here. Here, very close to what eventually becomes the Church of the Holy Sepulchre. So we have remains of the Romans in this area. Okay. We're going to come back to that when we talk about the Holy Sepulchre and we talk about the Empress Helena. But first, let's zoom out, right? And let's understand a little bit of who are the major groups that are in the Christian quarter. You have a whole bunch of groups, okay? But the ones who own the most property, the ones who have the most influence, are the Greeks, as in the Greek Orthodox, and the Franciscans, okay? And they own a lot. They control a lot. This, I brought you here, their symbols. And once you see their symbols, whenever you walk around the Christian quarter, you'll suddenly see them everywhere. Okay, so this on the left is the Greek symbol. It's two Greek letters, tau and p, as in taufos or grave, right? Grave, as in the Holy Sepulchre. Okay, the Franciscan symbol is this cross with a cross in each quadrant, so making up five crosses total. What's the symbol? What's the meaning? Whoever is not muted, please mute yourself. I don't know who's talking, but okay, what's going on here with the we said the Greeks is Greek letters and it's symbolic of the Holy Sepulchre. The Franciscans, right? Franciscans are Catholics. They've been here since the time of the Crusaders. We'll talk about them in a minute. What's the symbolism here? There's a lot of different symbolism. It could be the five wounds that Jesus has on his body. It could be the large crosses Jesus, and each of the small crosses is one of the four evangelists, one of the four authors of the Gospels. It could be Jesus in the four quarters of the world. You have a lot of these different symbolisms, but this is the Franciscan, the Jerusalem cross. Okay, this is called the Jerusalem cross. Franciscans have other symbols, but this is what you see is the coat of arms of the Kingdom of Jerusalem. It goes back to the time of the Crusaders. The Greeks. Okay, the Greeks are the oldest of the patriarchates of the churches in Jerusalem. They go back to the 4th century. In general, if you've been here, if you've been around a long time, you get to hold on to a lot of property. Not the Jews, because the Jews left and came back, but the Armenians, for example, and the Greeks have a lot of property in Jerusalem. Not only in the old city, by the way, but also in the new city. A lot of Rehovia is Greek Orthodox land. Talbia is Greek Orthodox land. And that's a lot of wealth that they have. They control much of the area of the Holy Sepulchre. And in fact, their major monastery headquarters has a bridge that goes directly into the Holy Sepulchre. It's right next door. They have a street, right? The Greek Orthodox Patriarchate Road, and their museum. The Franciscans is a different story. They have not been around as long, but they are very, very powerful. Okay? The Franciscans were founded in the 13th century by, as you can hear from the name, Saint Francis of Assisi, who comes to the Holy Land. And the Franciscans in the Crusades appoint themselves what they call Custodia Terra Sancta, the custodians of the Holy Land. And that gives them enormous power. They control many of the church sites, not just in Jerusalem, but in other parts of the country, around the Kinneret, in places in Nazareth, in all different kinds of places. They used to have their headquarters on Mount Zion by King David's tomb, but they are kicked out by the Mamluks. And they come and they establish themselves by a new gate, and it's called Saint Xavier. They also have churches in the Muslim quarter, and they are very, very prominent and very, very significant in Jerusalem. When we get to the Muslim quarter, we'll talk about them some more because they are also archaeologists, and they've discovered a lot of different things. But one of the places that they, and again, as you walk around, you'll see their symbols everywhere. This is the Saint Xavier's. This is their patriarchate. But this building on the right here is interesting, right? You can read it as Casanova. It's not Casanova, the Latin lover. It's Casa Nova, right? The new house, built in the 19th century. The Franciscans, because they were custodians of the churches, but also because they were scholars and archaeologists, okay, they were often the first port of call for Christian travelers coming to the land of Israel. You come to the land of Israel, where are you going to stay? Where are you going to go? You don't know anything, right? There's no Google Maps, there's no Facebook, there's no, how do you know what to do, right? So what you did is you went to the Franciscans and they gave you a place to stay, and that's what this is, Casanova. This is the latest iteration. It's from the mid 19th century, but there were earlier houses, hostels that pilgrims could stay in. You could still stay in this today. And they would give people travel advice and explain to them where to go and give them a clean and safe place to stay in return for a donation, right? That was the idea. There are other groups that are located in the Christian Quarter, among them the Greek Catholics, the Copts, the Ethiopians, the Armenians and the Syrians are outside, okay? But you have many different groups that are located, and this is just something that this woman named Shira El-Azari created. It's actually very useful, right? When you walk around in the Christian Quarter, you see all kinds of monks. You really, it's hard to know which is which. We're going to talk more about the Armenians and their pointy hood when we get to the Armenians, but this is just interesting to know. What do the Orthodox priests wear, right? The Russians, the Greeks, etc. What does everybody wear? And when you walk around in Jerusalem, you can see these guys, and just like there's a code for, you know, which Hasidim have which kinds of outfits, Lahavdil, you have the same thing for the church. Okay. We mentioned at the beginning that there are mosques, and there are Muslims in the Christian quarter. So there's a lot of Muslim store owners, but that's not what we're talking about. We are talking about two actual active mosques. Okay? The one on the left is called the Al-Hanka Mosque. And the one on the right is the Omaria, or the Mosque of Omar. The Mosque of Omar is really like around the corner from the Holy Sepulchre. Al-Hanka is also close, but it doesn't, you don't see the proximity as clearly. They are both from Mamluk times, not from Crusader times, after Crusader times. And there's a very interesting suggestion. Why are they flanking the Holy Sepulchre on either side? And this has not been proven by anybody, but I've heard it and I think it's fascinating, that maybe they're meant to nullify the power of the church, meaning you have these on either side and they kind of like control the airspace over the church. What is not conjecture, but we know from sources, is that the Mosque of Omar, which is right next to the Holy Sepulchre, is there because when Omar, the Muslim conqueror, comes, right? 630s, he comes to Jerusalem. The Byzantine Christians come out, they surrender to him, and they give him the honor of praying in the church. And he, to his credit, refuses this honor because he says, if I pray there, right, as the conqueror, as the Muslim leader, if I pray there, then your church is going to be turned into a mosque. And you don't want that to happen. So instead, I'm going to create a mosque next door to the Holy Sepulchre, and I will allow you to stay in your church, and we will have a mosque next door. Okay. The Muslims, by the way, we'll come back to this when we talk about status quo in the church. The Muslims, since the 13th century, have the keys to the Church of the Holy Sepulchre. It's a family, the Nusaybin family, that holds the keys, because the Christian groups do not trust each other. But we'll come back to that. Okay, there is a very small Jewish—I don't even want to say a community, but a group that has bought a building in the Moristan. It's called Neot David, 10 families, as well as a yeshiva and a synagogue, 80 students. It was leased by Atarat Kohanim in the 90s. Atarat Kohanim, you may or may not know, has been very involved in claiming and reclaiming Jewish properties in different parts of the city, not only in the Jewish quarter. In the Muslim quarter, it's really reclaiming. In the Christian quarter, Jews did not live in the Christian quarter. And we know from pre-48, Jews write about how, certainly like before 1929, they were very, very comfortable going into the Shuk, going into the Muslim quarter. And we know that Jews lived in the Muslim quarter before 1929. They wouldn't go anywhere near the Christian quarter, certainly not near the Church of the Holy Sepulchre. That was considered to be much more dangerous, which is fascinating because things have changed. But Atarat Kohanim wanted to have a Jewish presence in the Christian quarter, and that's why when you go into the main square of the Moristan, you'll see this big Israeli flags. A little bit incongruous, but they are living here in the Christian quarter. Okay, let's talk about the church because it is very, very significant. Why is it so significant? Okay, so this is the facade of the church today. It has been destroyed and rebuilt and destroyed and rebuilt many, many times. It was one of the causes for the Crusades. When news came back to Europe that some rumors and some true that the Muslims were attacking the church, that was one of the rallying cries for the Crusaders to come and to conquer Jerusalem. Why is it so important? Because already in the 4th century, as we're going to see in a moment with the Empress Helena. It is considered to be the site of the crucifixion of Jesus and the burial of Jesus. Okay, so when we talk today about the Via Dolorosa, the Way of Sorrows, we're going to talk about it when we get to the Muslim Quarter. The out of the 14 stations of the Via Dolorosa, the last five stations are in the church, right? It's the place where Jesus is crucified. It's the place where he's taken down from the cross, where he's ready for burial, right? Tahara, that we would use in Jewish terms, and where he's actually buried. So you can understand why this is such an important place. It is shared by the Greeks, the Franciscans, the Armenians, the Copts, the Syrians, and the Ethiopians. And because of that, there are very complicated arrangements of who is allowed to be where and when. Everybody's got their own area of the church. And God forbid that a Greek monk should sweep an area that belongs to the Franciscans or vice versa. We're going to talk about status quo in a second, but everybody zealously guards their status and their place. And everybody has, at holidays, everybody has a certain time. There's a very strict schedule of who can go where and when, because it's a lot of groups that don't necessarily like each other so much that have to share the same space. But let's go back a step. The Empress Helena is the mother of the Emperor Constantine. Constantine, in the early 4th century, converts to Christianity. He has a vision, and he converts, and he brings the whole Roman Empire along with him, and the Roman Empire accepts Christianity, and Christianity goes from being a despised and persecuted religion to becoming the official religion of the Roman Empire, right? Which is a fascinating switch, which has great, great impact on our whole region and certainly on Jews. But we are going to talk about Constantine's mother. Right. Helena is a very powerful woman. She's perhaps, I don't know if she's more significant, but she certainly is significant in our area. She is perhaps even more devout than her son. She converts. She comes to the land of Israel. She goes on a tour, but instead of visiting the sites, you know, and the tour guide telling her about them, she actually creates the sites, okay? And she comes and she makes some of the most important churches in the land of Israel. Okay, not just the Church of the Holy Sepulchre, but also the Church of the Nativity in Bethlehem, also the Church of, as you can see it on the right here, John Baharim, John the Baptist, in Ein Karim. Right? She comes here and she is told that this is the site of the crucifixion, and she makes the first shrine here, which over time evolves and becomes the church that we see. Now, is she correct? Right, that's a very interesting question. The Protestants say no, right? The Protestants are the only group that does not accept the Holy Sepulchre. They have a place called the Garden Tomb outside of Shar Shechem, but everybody else accepts it. Is she correct? Probably. Why? A number of reasons. First of all, we know there was a pagan temple built on the site of the Holy Sepulchre. The Romans, like every group that comes along, wants to erase the religion that was there before. If there was some kind of a shrine that the early Christians or Jewish Christians had built, they're going to come and they're going to put a pagan temple on top of it. That's very logical, right? That makes a lot of sense. It's probably outside the city, but perhaps the most exciting thing that was discovered is that in recent renovations in the church, they actually uncovered Jewish burial tombs that go back to the first century of the Common Era, meaning proving for us that A, this is outside the city, and B, this is a place where people were buried. Okay, so if this is a place where Jews were buried, that definitely adds to the authenticity of this site. Inside the church, as you can see from this diagram, is a very complicated place, which everybody's got their own piece. I'm just going to point out two things here. We're not going to do a whole very complicated story about the church, but two things here, right? This is the entrance over here. And you have the area of the crucifixion, okay? Very, very important. This is where they believe the crucifixion was. You have what's called the Stone of Unction. As you just come in Jewish terms, this is where the Tahara takes place, right? Jesus is taken down from the cross and he's purified and he's prepared for burial. And this is the place of the sepulcher, right, where he is buried. At the far end of this rotunda, that's where they excavated and they were able to find these tombs. So it is a very logical thing that this really is where Jesus is buried. And of course, over the years, much, much, much has been built, has been changed. There is no way to see any of the original tombs, but just to give you a little bit of a flavor, right? In the picture here on the left, okay, this is the altar of the crucifixion with, in the glass cases, stones from the crucifixion. Again, is it really? Is it not? This is getting into areas of belief and of tradition. And the picture on the right, and these are pictures that were taken when they are not, this is not normal because usually this is packed with people. This is that stone of unction, stone of anointing. Everybody comes, they kiss it, they touch it. It's very, very important to Christian pilgrims that come and visit here. And just to understand, right, for everybody, everyone from the Christian world except for Protestants, this is an incredibly important highlight of their trip to Jerusalem. This is the highlight, right? This is why you come on pilgrimage. And if you are a devout Catholic, Armenian, Ethiopian, Copt, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, you are going to make it your business to visit this church. Okay, let's get into the story of the status quo. In the 18th century, there are, because of all the various arguments over who gets to be where and when, there's something that is established as the status quo, meaning agreements about who controls what that cannot be changed. As we said before, Muslim families that have the keys to the church already in the 13th century, but in the 18th century, they come up with these agreements about what has to be, and essentially everything in this church stays in stasis from that point. And I want to bring for you two great examples. Okay, one is the ladder. Right, if you go to the Holy Sepulchre today, you can see that on top, on a little balcony right outside the window on the second floor is a ladder, right? Everybody sees a ladder, I hope. Right, here's our ladder. If you look back at old photographs, and this is a photograph from 1856, you could see the ladder, right? Same ladder, same place. What's the story? So in the 19th century, there were monks that lived inside the church. And the gates were locked and they were only opened on holidays. And if you lived inside the church, how did you get supplies? How did you get provisions? So what you did was somebody went shopping for you and then you climbed out on the ladder onto the balcony, you lowered a basket, you got what you needed and you went back inside. So in the 19th century, this ladder was very useful. We do not do this anymore. However, because the ladder was there, it's in the status quo and it can never be moved and it has to stay there. So I think that that's a crazy story. And it's a story that's like, you can't go to the Church of the Holy Sepulchre without hearing a tour guide tell that story. Something that people tell less, and I noticed it and it was fascinating to me. If you look at pictures from before the 1930s, you can see that above the doorway to the church are these very beautifully decorated carved stone lintels. If you go to the Rockefeller Museum, right, very close to Damascus Gate, Rockefeller Museum is built in the 1930s. And the idea was to have a representation of all different religions. And they actually have mosaics from synagogues, and they went to the Muslims and they asked them for wooden panels from Har Habayit, and they went to the Christians and they said, you know, you have these lintels, they're really old, maybe you'll replace them, and why don't you give them to us to the museum? And these are displayed in the museum, okay? But if you go to the church today, there's nothing there. There's these little kind of metal placeholders that were meant to hold the lintel in place, but they were never replaced because replacing it would require everybody to agree on what's going to be there. So this idea of status quo is very strong in the church, and it's a fascinating thing. The consequence of certain groups getting there before other groups, right, means that those powerful groups and those groups that have been around longer can push out the groups that are less powerful. One of those groups are the Ethiopian Christians, right? We know about Ethiopian Jews, but there were Ethiopian Christians as well. And the Ethiopian Christians came late right? And they were not particularly strong. They fought with the Copts, and basically what happened is they got the rooftop, right? And they were pushed out of there, and eventually they said, enough of that, we're not interested. And they built themselves a very big and beautiful church, not in the old city, but in the new city, right? And if you know, in Jerusalem, there's a street that is called Ethiopia Street. It used to be called Rehov HaChabashim, but that's like not a PC term. So now it's called Rehov Ethiopia. And they moved out. And there still are Ethiopian chapels, very, very small ones on the side of the Holy Sepulchre, but they got sick of not having enough room. And so they moved outside. Leaving the church, if you go right outside the church is a very big and very nice open shopping area. It is much more airy and modern and light than the Shuk, right? Okay, it's not the same as in the new city, but certainly in the old city, certainly in the Christian quarter and the Muslim quarter, it's very open. It's very lovely. It's got this big fountain, which during the light festival in Jerusalem, they made it into like a snow globe, right? And it looks very different. What's the story behind it? This is a place called the Moristan. The Turks gave some of it to the Germans and some of it to the Greeks. And we're going to see there's a German church, the Church of the Redeemer, that's right over here. But the Greeks, what they did is they turned it into kind of a modern shopping center with the idea of attracting revenue. And there still are quite a few stores there. It's an important place. It's got this strange name, the Moristan, right? What does that mean? It's actually a messing up of a Persian word. Persian word is bimuristan, which means a hospital. What do hospitals have to do with this place? So we hear about a group called the Hospitallers. Okay? When the Crusaders are here, all right, Crusaders, 1,000 years ago, give or take, we have different groups of Crusaders. We have the Templars, we have different people. We have a group called the Hospitallers or the Knights of St. John. Like their name, right? Hospitallers has the word hospital in it. Their goal, they were military, they were fighters, but they also had a job of helping and healing the sick. Sick and the wounded, as you can imagine, there were quite a lot of those in Crusader times. And they built a huge hospital. Now, this is a fascinating thing, right? The name Moristan preserves this hospital. And we hear about it in various texts from the time, right? We have pilgrims who visit who talk about this very, very big hospital that was just a very large area that served everybody, that even once Jews started to come back to Jerusalem, even had Jews in it, which is fascinating. But we didn't have any remains of it. Okay. In 2013, there was a company called the Grand Bazaar Company that owns a bunch of stores in the Christian Quarter, and they decided they wanted to build a restaurant. But as you know, anywhere in Israel and certainly in Jerusalem, you can't build anything until you excavate first. And they excavated, and underneath the Moristan, they found the remains of this massive hospital, which has still not been opened up to the public, but it's supposedly like enormous ceilings, just an incredibly massive place. So we heard about it. The name was preserved, but now we actually know that it exists. What happens to the Knights of St. John, to the Hospitallers? Hey, if this looks familiar to you, it's called a Maltese cross. Hey, after the Crusades are over, after the Crusaders are kicked out of the land of Israel by the Mamluks, the Hospitallers go to Malta. And this is why it's called the Maltese Cross. They reestablish themselves in Malta as the Knights of St. John. But during the time of the Crusades, they are a super powerful order. They build fortresses in various parts of the Middle East. This one on the left here is called Belvoir or Kohav HaYarden. It's in the Jordan Valley. It's a little bit it's between Beit Shan and Tveria. It's massive, still very intact fortress. And even larger than that in Syria, there's something called the Krak de Chevalier. That's what you see here on the right. So the Hospitallers were a very, very powerful order. And that's why they were able to build this huge hospital, which hopefully one day will be opened up and exposed to the public. Moving into more modern times, okay? The Germans, both the Catholics and the Protestants, were powerful in Jerusalem. And in 1898, they get a visit, a royal visit from Kaiser Wilhelm, which is a very, very, very big deal. And in his honor, this is in 1898, a bunch of things happen. Number one, the Ottoman Turks very much want to find favor with him. So in order for him to come into the old city with his entourage, they actually break open the walls of the old city. And if you've ever driven into the old city from Shar Yafo, you can thank Kaiser Wilhelm, right? And if you've ever been stuck in, traffic jams in the narrow streets of the old city, you can also thank Kaiser Wilhelm because they broke open the walls of the old city so that Kaiser Wilhelm could drive in. Okay? So that's one thing that happens because of Kaiser Wilhelm. Another thing that happens is a lot of the German groups, the Catholics and the Protestants, build things in Kaiser Wilhelm, Kaiser and the Kaiserina Victoria. They build things in their honor. This is the Lutheran Church of the Redeemer, the Protestant church built by the Protestants. They built this in the honor of Kaiser Wilhelm. It's one of the most modern. It's right near the Holy Sepulchre, right? One of the oldest churches. This is one of the newer churches. Very modern, very imposing, very impressive. They also build Augusta Victoria. That's the hospital on Harezi Tim. The Catholics build the Dormition Church on Hartzion. Right? So this is a very, very big deal, this royal visit. Kind of an interesting little footnote is there's somebody else who meets with Kaiser Wilhelm who it's very, very big deal for him. It's probably much less of a big deal for Kaiser Wilhelm. And that, of course, is Theodor Herzl, right? Theodor Herzl goes to Mikveh Yisrael. He has a maybe like a 10-minute meeting with Kaiser Wilhelm, which he sees as, portending great things. Kaiser Wilhelm's going to support the Zionist movement. Not so much. But for Herzl, it seems to have been a very, very big deal. So the visit of the Kaiser has a great impact on Jerusalem. Less of an impact on Zionism. And just to kind of finish up our different Christians story, is the story of the Protestants, right? Now we said already the Protestants do not like the Holy Sepulchre. They do not see it as a holy place. They have their own site, which is called the Garden Tomb, which is north of the city, but we're not going to talk about that right now. We're going to talk about where their church is and where their compound is. The Protestants, of course, are later than the other Christian groups, right? Protestants only begin with the Reformation during the time of the Renaissance. So there are no Protestants in the time of the Crusades. There certainly are no Protestants in the time of the Byzantine period. Protestants show up in Jerusalem in the 19th century. And the Ottoman Turks look at them and they say, "Who the heck are you? We've never heard of you before. You're not Greeks, you're not Russians, you're not Armenians, you're not friends. We don't know who you are. We're not giving you any land. We're not recognizing you as important. And in any case, you don't want to be in the Holy Sepulchre, so go ahead and find your own spot." So what do? They get a piece of land very close to Jaffa Gate, right? If you know, when you come into Jaffa Gate, there's the massive Tower of David. Literally across from the Tower of David is what's called Christ Church, and that's what you're looking at. Now, the Protestants come to Jerusalem with a very specific goal. Okay. The first groups that come is something called the London Society for the Promotion of Christianity Among the Jews. It's not a subtle name. Okay. They come as missionaries. Their goal is to convert the Jews because the belief is that when the Jews are converted, then Jesus will return. Then the second coming will happen. And the first one who comes is somebody named Hans John Nikolaisen. The first bishop, the first Protestant bishop of Jerusalem is someone named Shlomo Alexander. He is a convert from Judaism to Christianity, and they go full out attempting to convert the Jews of Jerusalem. Now, they build a church. We'll see the church in a minute, but that's not going to bring the Jews in. What's going to bring the Jews in? Services, because we're in the early 19th century and the Jewish community of Jerusalem in general, has nothing. They got no education. They've got no medical services. They've got nothing. So what does the church do? They build hospitals. They create vocational schools, all of these things that make them appealing to the Jews. However, it boomerangs, right? And instead of the Jews converting to Christianity, it finally pushes this very fractious and divided Jewish community in Jerusalem to creating their own institutions, their own hospitals, their own orphanages. And so we have to thank the Christians for doing that. But they try very hard, and it still exists today, by the way, It's not called the London Society for the Promotion of Christianity Among the Jews anymore. It's called the CMJ, Christian Missionary Mission to the Jews, the Christian Mission to the Jews. You can see that on the sign, right? You have a nice Star of David. You have the word Emmanuel. You have Hebrew writing, Knesiyat HaMashiach. And there actually are services not only on Sunday, but also on Saturday. If you go into the church looks more like a synagogue than a church. Hey, there is nothing that looks really overtly Christian. There's a ton of writing in Hebrew. This is on the front. It looks like an Aron Kodesh. It's not an Aron Kodesh. And even today, there are not so many diaspora Jews, because diaspora Jews are more aware of missionizing and proselytizing, but Israeli Jews who are very innocent about these things, and they get pulled in by this. And anytime anyone walks into the compound there, they give them a whole spiel about how, this is the true Judaism, and you have to return to Christ, and blah blah blah. So it's a rather disturbing but rather interesting place. Inside, you also have models created by a Swiss German Protestant named Conrad Schick, who did a ton of research in Jerusalem. It's very, very important. And he built, among other things, a model. He was asked by the Muslims to build a model of the Temple Mount. And he got access that nobody else got, and he found all kinds of secret underground tunnels. And this model was lost for a while, and it was brought back, and it's in the small museum that's in the Christchurch compound. So that's a very interesting place. And I'll just finish by saying the Christian Quarter has a lot of very colorful and very interesting, not just churches and people that are living there, but a few stores and characters that are very interesting. This is Elia Photo Services. This is a store that is owned by an Armenian, the Kavejian family, who the grandfather, as a child, as a toddler, was saved from the Armenian genocide. He apprenticed to a photographer, and he himself became a photographer. And his hobby was a society photographer. That was what he did for a living. He took wedding pictures. He did, right? But on weekends, and this is in the 1920s, the 1930s, he went out and he just took pictures of places. And this is in the 20s and 30s. He had these heavy glass plates. He kept them all in his attic in his house in the Armenian Quarter. And when they were cleaning out the attic in the 1980s, his son said to him, "I found all these plates. What should I do with them?" And he said, "Throw them out." And they fortunately did not. And they developed all the pictures. And we have these priceless, amazing pictures of Jerusalem and of the whole land of Israel from the 20s, from the 30s, from the 40s. And they opened up the store, and they have these time capsule photos. You can look this up online, Elia Photo Service, and they have a whole YouTube video about it. It's fascinating. On the right here is a guy named Bilal Abu Khalif, who has a fabric store where he brings in fabrics from Syria and from Morocco, and he's very, very interesting, and he gives you a whole spiel about these amazing fabrics. And on the bottom, this is Newgate. This is an organization called Melia, Palestinian Christian Arabs, whose goal is to help women, right? Arab women who can't really make a living because they are not allowed to go out to work, because they're living in this very traditional society. So what they do is they have them do embroidery at home, and it's like a cooperative, and they sell it in this store to provide an income for these women. So a lot of interesting stuff going on in the Christian Quarter. Let's see. I see we have a couple of questions I didn't answer before. Which series did I do the Jewish Quarter? It was about the excavations in the Jewish Quarter. I don't remember, probably from Tanakh stuff. If you send me an email, I will try to find it. What did they do with the Jewish remains that were buried in the Holy Sepulchre? They did not find remains, as far as I know. They found the tombs, right? I don't think they found any bones in it, but if they did, I'm sure that they spirited them out of there pretty quickly so that nobody would protest. It was not permitted for other religions to missionize in Israel. This was certainly not true in the 19th century under the Ottoman Turks. Nobody cares. Today, how do they get around it? I think that they don't publicly missionized, they have services, right? They don't go out in the street and hand out pamphlets. But if you want to come to the church, nobody's going to stop you, right? Bela Gil says it is legal. I would have to check into the status. I don't remember like the details of it. Okay, other questions, other comments? Anybody have anything they want to say? Yeah, so do I give tours to Christian groups? I don't go into the church. I talk about it outside. Oh, you can't missionize minors. Thank you. Is that the law? That's interesting. I talk about it outside. I tell the history. I don't talk about the, the cathartic religious epiphany you're going to have because that's not what I do. But I do go around the Christian Quarter and I do talk about the history of it and I think it's fascinating. Okay. Everybody, next week, I know this is 1 week on where we're going, it's off, it's very confusing, but next week we are on the Ezras Hashem. Everyone should have a beautiful Shabbat. I am not going to make those Torah in Motion announcements because I don't know what they are, so sorry. Look it up on the website. Thank you, everybody. Shabbat Shalom.